welcome to the Howard Love Show with Dr. Mike. Dr. Michael McGee here, your host. It's good to have you with us. Hope you're doing well and having a good week. We have with us today as our guest, Andrew Mann, to talk to us about opiate addiction and recovery. Welcome, Andrew.
Thank you, Dr. McGee. I appreciate you having me on. I really do.
Oh, it's great to have you. So tell our audience a little bit about yourself. Tell us your story.
As you said, I am a recovering addict. I wrote a book titled Such Unfortunate, once I had gotten through my addiction, and I wanted to help people through my experience. I wanted to give back and help people that were struggling with the same things I had struggled with through life, and that's basically how I got here to speaking to you. If you'd like me to go back and explain a little bit about my addiction and how everything went through, I can do that.
Sure. I think that would be helpful to give people a context.
Great. I grew up in basically what would be considered a nightmare for a child. I grew up in a family that was void of love and very abusive. And through that, I dealt with a lot of issues. I developed depression and anxiety. I never had parents who ever said, I love you. I never heard those words from my parents. And it was just kind of an all-around, and you read in the book how it was just a nightmare for a child. And I ended up, like I said, becoming clinically depressed. At age 12, I was prescribed Xanax and Zoloft. One is an antidepressant and the other one's a benzodiazepine because I was having panic attacks. And that was really my first sort of foray into addiction because I didn't realize that benzodiazepines were addictive medicine, but I started taking that very young and became addicted to that by the time I was 13 years old. Through high school, I dealt with things such as bullying. When you've been an abused child, you don't create healthy boundaries with others. So I sort of made myself an easy target. So that wasn't, and I get into it in the book and how that affected me. But basically, later on in life, all these issues sort of, I barely made it through high school. Like I said, I was dealing with awful panic attacks. I started drinking alcohol very strongly, and basically it led to an opiate addiction. That started with Percocet and Oxycontin and ended up with heroin. And I ended up from, you know, living in a suburban town, I ended up on the streets of Camden, New Jersey, homeless as a heroin addict. And and I was at everyone had given up on me. I was basically considered a lost cause, and I had even given up on myself. And then some people that I really consider angels came into my life, and one in particular was a woman who loved me when no one else would. She refused to give up on me, and she loved me until I was able to love myself. And through her, I was able to find the strength to pull myself out of this addiction. And once I did, that's when I realized that, you know, I got to see through the many attempts at rehabs and everything, I got to see what was wrong with the system. And that's another reason I wanted to write the book, because I know there's a lot of people out there suffering, and I wanted to help as many people as possible. So that is
beautiful. Tell us about your journey from addiction to recovery. How did you attain recovery?
I went to a long-term rehabilitation center, and I had been to rehabilitation centers before, but the thing which was different about this time, I had never talked about the abuse, or I had never discussed that I never had love in my life in any way. If someone ever told me they loved me, I didn't believe it, and I sort of cringed and went away from it. It was a really uncomfortable thing to hear. And so when I went to this long-term treatment center, the woman I told you about, she wrote me a letter every day, and she also got me, it was a little booklet, and each day it had a different thing that she loved about me and was good about me. And so I would receive these letters, and she would write them saying, you know, don't give up, you can do it, all this stuff. And I had never had anyone that was that, you know, that ever saw that positivity in me. So she started to come to visit me 3 times a week, and she encouraged me to talk about the trauma I had suffered as a child. And so I finally let that stuff out, and once I was able to get that out of me, I finally was able to heal. And it didn't happen overnight. It was like a weight was lifted off me, but slowly I was able to start healing. And once I let that in, it was just like, you know, when you've held something inside for so long, which I swore I would never tell anyone. As a man, I wasn't going to tell anyone I was abused as a child. And once I got that out, it was a huge weight lifted off my back. So I went through the whole treatment, and when I left, I actually did things completely different. I started going to Nar-Anon meetings. I also got involved with helping other people with addiction. I started speaking at detoxes and rehabs and sharing my experience. And, you know, through that and dealing with other people that had gone through addiction, I was able to get a week clean and then a month clean and then 6 months clean and then a year clean and then multiple years clean. And for me, that was really a miracle. I couldn't get a few minutes clean, let alone a day. And so for me to sit here and have multiple years clean is an absolute miracle. And
wow.
That's really why I wanted to write the book, because if someone that was as bad as I was can do this, I really believe anyone out there can.
Yeah. Well, you know, you're pointing out some really so important things that when we keep our trauma a secret, it possesses us. And you liberated yourself by finally getting the abuse and neglect out where you could share that with other people. And in the sharing of it, you got some distance from it. But you also had an angel in your life who was very loving and supportive. Was that a romantic partner, or was that just a friend?
So romantic. I'm married to her now. I finally, we just got married recently, about 6 months ago.
So. Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, she's an amazing woman. She never went through what I went through in life. She's not an addict or anything, but she really is, like you said, an angel. She's such a good person. She makes me a good person just being around her. And, yes, I will be grateful to her for the rest of my life, without a doubt. And
you know what's amazing, Andrew, is that a lot of people who suffer from trauma and neglect, they feel that they're so unlovable, and they feel that other people are so unreliable and not trustworthy that they really close down their hearts to receiving love and support from others. And yet you in the depths of your addiction, there was something different about you that you were able to open your heart to receive her love and support. I wonder about that.
Yes. I don't know, but you're absolutely correct. That's when you go through trauma, especially in childhood, you stop trusting people. It's so hard. And it was so hard for me to try to have a relationship with anyone, even in high school. And it just wasn't the way everyone else did. It was just so hard. You just didn't understand what this person wanted out of you. And I would deal with, if I was trying to be intimate with someone, I would get flashbacks. And so the only way to avoid that was to be drunk out of my mind. And so here I am, 15 years old. I'm wanting to, you know, be intimate with somebody or kiss them and not have flashbacks. I had to drink, you know, to the point I was intoxicated. It really was a difficult situation. I didn't understand it all as a child. Now that I can look back on it, and dissect it. I understand everything now, and that's one of my goals. Is I'm trying to start a foundation to help people that have, you know, have addiction, that have been abused. I want it to be. I believe in the healing power of animals too, and so I kind of wanted to start a foundation that was sort of like a half rehab, half animal shelter. So that's one of the things I'm working on. Yeah, I believe.
Very cool. So for you were able to open your heart and receive the love of this, what is your wife's name?
Karen.
You were able to see the love of Karen. I wonder what it was that attracted her, that she saw something good in you, worthy of loving and supporting. Looking back on that, what did she see that perhaps you didn't see at the time?
It's hard to tell. Because for me, I thought she should have left me. I really did. I thought she should have given up on me. But she said to me, she said there was something in me, like you said, that she saw, and she knew. She just said, "I know you're going to do it this time." And my own mother had told her that she had to cut me off and forget about me, and she refused to do it. It was really amazing because it was what I needed, and I didn't even know that. I don't know how she knew that. Like you said, I believe there's some kind of divine intervention because it doesn't make sense. She should have, under all circumstances, said this guy has got a drug problem, goodbye with him, you know, but she didn't. And I'll always forever be grateful to her. And she's in the book. A lot of the book is I dedicated the book to her.
Wow. You know, Andrew, this is so powerful. I think that that for so many people who suffered trauma and neglect in the midst of addiction, this need to open the heart and trust and allow ourselves to be loved and borrow the love of others. A lot of people will get in contact with what I affectionately call normies, a normie. And a normie is somebody who was well-loved and doesn't have, you know, major psychiatric issues or trauma or woundedness. And there's a real role for normies in the world of serving as a model to help role model what it's like to love and be loved. And they can teach us what we maybe didn't learn when we were growing up.
Absolutely. I agree 100%.
I think the other thing, Andrew, I want to point out, I don't know if you've heard of the work of Dr. Roger Myers from the University of New Mexico. Have you heard of his work at all?
The name sounds familiar, but nothing is ringing a bell off the top of my head.
So let me tell you and our audience a little bit about him, because this really applies to you, and it really applies to so many people perhaps in our audience who either know somebody with addiction or who are struggling with addiction. Roger Myers developed an approach to helping loved ones with addiction, like yourself, called the CRAFT approach, C-R-A-F-T, Community Reinforcement and Family Training. And it turns out that probably what Karen did with you is very, very powerful. That loved ones have about roughly an 80% chance of inspiring somebody with addiction to move into recovery. We have a lot of power and influence over each other, as Karen did for you. And basically, the basic elements of CRAFT there's multiple elements, but the most important ones are unconditional positive communication, love, and support. That's unconditional, whether the loved one is addicting or not. And then you combine that with rewarding recovery behavior, rewarding recovery, and then removing those rewards when somebody's active in their addiction, but still not abandoning them, really staying emotionally connected to them and not giving up on them and having relentless hope. And then that's combined with not shielding people from the natural negative consequences of their illness. So it's just something that people should be aware of, is that we have a powerful impact on each other. And if there were more people like your wife in the world, it can make just a huge difference for people struggling with addiction and trauma.
I couldn't agree with you more. You're absolutely right.
That is just such an inspiring story. Now, did you go on medications at all for buprenorphine or naltrexone or anything for opiate use disorder?
In the past, I've used them, and I would say that they did help me. I've used methadone and I've used buprenorphine. Methadone actually helped me to get off the street. That was one of the things that did help me. So I am grateful to both of those medications. And I have friends that, you know, are caught up in the addiction, and if they have access to it, you know, you can always go to a rehab and take your time and get clean. But a lot of people on the streets that don't have the money to get into a rehab or can't for whatever reason, you know, buprenorphine's been great because they get to see a doctor once a month, and it's been very helpful for them. And they do have methadone clinics as well, because opiate addiction is a horrible thing. I have tried both of them in the past, and both of them it did help me. If I had really worked it, the program with them, I'm sure they would have been a much more effective, but they did help me, and I will be grateful to methadone. I will.
It's a great tool. Obviously, it's not the total answer, but
no.
It can sort of stop the addiction process so that you can attend to healing, as you did.
Exactly.
Can you describe for us a little bit, what was the healing process like for you in terms of coming to terms with the neglect and abuse that you experienced?
Well, I had to, first I had to get healed from the withdrawal of opiates and benzodiazepines I had used for so many years that it took months before I felt well enough to really just get out of bed in the morning. And once I was able to heal the physical part, then the real battle came on, which is the mental part, because, like you said, I had left rehab before and dealt with the physical part, but I didn't deal with the real trauma that had gone on in there. So I always went back and used. And that's what I would like to do in my rehab, was to help people deal with that, make sure they deal with that, not just the physical. But the physical healing, it was remarkable because, like I said, I had such a bad anxiety problem my whole life. I've taken myself, before I turned 21 years old, I went to the emergency room about 50 times, believing I was having a heart attack and dying. And it was all from severe panic attacks.
And now, have those panic attacks resolved, Andrew?
Yes. I have not had a panic attack since, you know, years, since I've been clean.
Wow.
And that is a miracle in itself.
Now, do you think that is related somehow to dealing with the trauma as a child?
I do. I believe that when I was a child and I went through this trauma, this is what I believe. I believe my brain didn't develop the correct way where a loving child they'd have all the normal chemicals flowing, like serotonin, dopamine, norepinephrine, all the endorphins the right way. Mine were really messed up, and I believe that I would, you know, where other people would have the right amount of chemicals, waking up for them with an exciting adventure, and they were happy to get to school, and, you know, let's take on the world, where for me, when your brain chemicals aren't right, the world doesn't feel right. You're not motivated. I never looked forward to the future. I was just trying to survive the next day with as little pain as possible. And I believe that put me in a depression. And when you're depressed, I believe there's a direct link to anxiety. And so the more depressed I was, I didn't realize I was depressed because I never experienced happiness to realize I was depressed. You know, I had always been at a depressed level in my life. I never felt like I do today. I had never been able to just sit down and enjoy a movie. Sitting in my own skin was terrible as a child. I always had to be moving around or doing something to get away from myself. And So that I do believe that the anxiety was a direct result of the trauma that I had dealt with.
You know, Andrew, you mentioned so much for us to talk about. There's so much to unpack and talk about in terms of your healing process, which is so incredibly inspiring to me, and I'm sure to our listeners, so inspiring. So we're going to take a little break now and then come back. You're listening to the How to Love Show with Dr. Mike and our guest, Andrew Mann. Stay tuned. We'll be right back to talk more about trauma, addiction, and healing after this break. Welcome back to the How to Love Show with Dr. Mike and with our guest, Andrew Mann, an inspiring story of recovering from trauma and addiction and now helping others to do the same. Welcome back, Andrew.
Thank you.
Yeah. You know, Andrew, before the break, I was noticing how I want to point out that when we suffer neglect and abuse, it really does change the brain. It really does damage the brain. It causes a form of emotional brain damage, which you experience as just not being uncomfortable in your skin and needing to distract yourself, and depression, anxiety, panic attacks was really a result of the trauma that you experienced. And you were just trying to use drugs, alcohol, opiates. I think it's important that we have compassion about that. We have such a stigma for people with heroin addiction, but you were just trying to not be in pain. You were trying you were just trying to deal with your trauma the best way you knew how.
Yes, I used to wake up every day believing I was going to die. It was like, you know, I'll put it this way, if someone goes through a traumatic experience, say they go through a robbery and they feel they're going to die, people will go through that and they'll get treatment for that for years. That was every day of my life. And when I took an opiate, it took that away. And I don't know anyone who, you know, if you were, it wasn't that I didn't go out to party with opiates. When I first took them and they were taking that away, that was all I wanted. I wasn't trying to get, you know, people have this false idea that it's just people going out wanting to get high and all this other stuff. And I just wanted relief. And at first, opiates provided it. It was like it was the key in my brain. You know, it was like taking the anxiety away, the depression, and it put me in a world where I felt like everyone else. You know?
Yeah. Only they worked long term, wouldn't it be great if they really normalized functioning in a long term way? That would be great.
Oh, it would have been. I would have wanted to live like that, but it doesn't. But if I could have lived the way I felt when I first started taking opiates, I don't think there's anything I could have lived like a normal person, basically.
Well, you know, they say that these addictive medications, they numb. What we do is we numb our pain with pleasure. They did probably normalize your endorphin system that was damaged by your trauma. But ultimately, that solution of numbing pain with pleasure ends up being very much good now, bad later behavior because of the development of tolerance and dependence. Which happens when you use pleasure-inducing substances this way. But so you kind of have to put down that strategy to embrace another way, which you did, which was the way of confronting and healing your trauma.
Correct. Yes, exactly. And you're 100% right about the tolerance and everything that develops. It's exactly right. But you're right. It was weird because I had never been able to concentrate in school until I took opiates. And when I took opiates, I would get A's in school. So it was, you're right. I think it normalized my brain, but, you know, that only goes so far. It would be wonderful if there was a medicine that you could give to people with trauma that just fixed that. But as far as I know, there isn't anything out there like that.
No, not yet anyway. But you know, what's so inspiring, Andrew, is that for everybody listening, is to know that you can heal that emotional and relational brain damage of trauma by doing the trauma work that you did combined with sobriety. It is possible to change and you are, it is possible to heal. You're a living example of that.
Yes, I am. Yes, you are absolutely right. I am a living example of that. It's not easy, but it's so worthwhile, and I'd recommend it to anyone out there. I get a lot of people that write to me about the book, and I try to respond to every one of them. I get family members that write to me, and, you know, I tell them the same thing. If I could do this and get through this, there isn't anyone out there that can't do it. And
yeah,
that's really
what a,
the way
what a great
it.
Story. Now, tell us a little bit about your family. What's your relationship now with your parents after you've gone through this? Where are you at with them?
My father passed away a few years ago, and my mother and I, we don't have a relationship. It's just not a healthy situation for me. It's a shame, but we don't. You know, it's really just not a healthy interaction for me. So I've sort of had to make my own family for now, and maybe sometime in the future there can be some healing and, you know, that, and I wish it was different. It's hard for me to say that, you know, but, you know, if you read the book, people will understand more about what I went through, and right now it's best for me to avoid that.
Yeah, for right now, to protect yourself, you have to maintain some distance from your mom, because of her. You know what? I don't know if this fits for you, Andrew, but I like to think of this as having a love wound or a love deficit disorder of some sort. And I think I'm imagining. I don't know who. I take it you were abused physically. Is that right?
Correct.
And primarily by your father, I'm guessing.
No. I was abused sexually by my mother.
Oh, abused sexually by your mother. Oh
yeah.
My gosh. Has she made amends for that at all to you, or no?
No, she hasn't. She once I came out with it, she just stopped talking to me. So,
wow. Okay.
Yeah. So that's and so you can imagine how difficult that was as a child, a male child, to speak about that.
Yeah.
And it's so.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
The
you
shame.
Can imagine the damage that does to a male child.
Oh so, yeah. Tell us about how that damaged you, do you think?
Well, when I would try to have a relationship with a woman, you know, as a child, the girls would be interested in me, so they'd come up and, you know, Andrew, and I would like them, but as soon as we started being intimate, I would have flashbacks of that, and then I would just tell them, I'm sorry, I can't talk to you anymore, and I would want nothing to do with them. And they didn't understand why, so they would get angry. And that happened multiple times. Here I am wanting to have a normal relationship, like all the rest of my friends are, and I can't. Because any time, unless I was completely bombed out of my mind drunk, I would have flashbacks of abuse. And right away I'd be disgusted by whoever I was around, and that was the end of it.
Oh, how damaging. I'm so sorry that happened to you. Oh my gosh, but how wonderful that you're able to now to have moved beyond that. That's just really wonderful. Well, listen, let's take another break real quickly, and then we'll talk more. You're listening to the How to Love Show with Dr. Mike and our guest Andrew Mann, who has recovered from trauma and addiction, is recovering, and has written a book of his story of his recovery called Such Unfortunate. Please stay with us, and we'll get together again right after this break. Welcome back to the How to Love Show with Dr. Mike here. Dr. Michael McGee, your host, with our guest Andrew Mann, talking about trauma, addiction, and recovery. Andrew, you know, you suffered a very traumatic sexual abuse at the hands of your mother. And I'm wondering, where are you at now in terms of understanding why she did that to you and coming to a place of forgiveness? Tell our audience a little bit about that process for you.
Well, I had an experience before I got better. I was homeless in Camden, New Jersey, and there was this really nice woman who one day stopped her car on the side of the street. Now, I'm some man homeless in the most dangerous city, and here's this woman, probably 65 years old, weighs all of 90 pounds, and she's not afraid at all to come up to me. She gave me some money and food, and she would come see me almost every day and do that on her way to work. And one day, out of nowhere, this woman knew nothing about my story. She stopped, and she grabbed my hand, and she said, "I need to tell you something. I was an alcoholic, and my father sexually abused me, and I had to forgive him to get better. I just wanted you to know that." And then she drove away. Now, this woman knew nothing about me, that just I was some homeless guy on the side of the street that was a drug addict. That's it. And that was kind of a moment where I just really thought that that made sense. So while I've been going through this, I know I have to forgive my mother for, even if not for her, but for me, living with that whole, you know, living with, it's just not healthy. It's not good to live with anger, and it doesn't do anything. It hurts the, you know, it hurts me more than it hurts the person I'm angry at. And so I've really started to try to understand where she was coming from.
How did you come to understand why she did that to you? What was going on for her? Any idea?
I think she was abused by her father, and instead of recognizing that, I think she decided to pass that on instead of breaking the cycle, realizing what damage it did to her. She decided to pass that on. And
she was trying to get love and closeness through sexual contact with you, as she had experienced from her father. Is that right?
I believe that is, yes. I believe she was abused as a child. The more I think about it, the more I remember things about, you know, things I've heard. Things make sense now. But instead of recognizing that and seeing the damage it did to her, she wasn't able to break that cycle, and you know, which is a shame. But I do feel for her, but it's difficult. It's a difficult situation because I've suffered so much, but I know I have to forgive her to move on with my life. So I do.
You know, forgiveness is such a, maybe we can talk a little bit more about that. Where are you at in terms? I don't think that we can forgive. I think forgiveness is something that happens. I think we can nurture forgiveness. We can cultivate, you know, hoping that forgiveness will happen. But where are you at in terms of your process of forgiveness?
You know, I still. It's a work in progress, I'll put it that way. There are days where it's easier than others.
Uh-huh.
You know, again, the more you read my story, I went through some just awful situations. There were times where I took a hammer and broke my own hand because I was in withdrawal, and the doctors wouldn't give me painkillers unless I had a broken bone. So I really suffered.
Oh my God!
To death when I was homeless.
Wow.
So I've been through. If anyone reads my book, you know, they'll understand. I've been through hell my whole life, and this is the first time I've ever had some freedom in my life. And people that have read the book wrote to me and they said, you know, it's an absolute miracle you're not in jail or dead. It's an absolute miracle that you were able to turn your life around. So that part, when I think about what I went through, but then again, I wouldn't be who I am today if I didn't go through that. I would have never met Karen, who has just been, like you said, an angel in my life, and I would never be able to have the chance to help as many people as I can. That really is my goal. I'm trying to start a foundation. I even started a GoFundMe page under my Such Unfortunates because I did a radio show, and a guy said, you have to start this foundation, and I love animals too. So if I was able to help animals and people and start a foundation and actually help save lives, if my life was able to come to meaning like that, then it'd be a lot easier for me to forgive. And I'd say, you know what, I went through all this stuff for a reason. It's still not easy, though, because, you know, my life was hell. But it's if I'm able to do that, which I'm really hoping I am, it'll make it a lot easier.
Well, you know, Andrew, another point that I think is important for our audience to understand is that recovery is a lifelong process. It's not like at some point you're all recovered and you reach total bliss and forgiveness. It sounds like you're still working to cultivate for forgiveness to arise in your life. Is that fair?
Yes. Yes. It's a lot better than it was. You know, I was very angry when, you know, once my head cleared up from the drugs, it was like, you're like a raw nerve. Everything is just, you know, and it's just, you know, you wake up and you're just kind of left in the world with, you know, okay, here's the world, and you've been, you know, and it was upsetting because, you know, your parents are supposed to be there to love and protect you and guide you, not to hurt you and harm you. And, you know, life's hard enough as it is. Imagine if you had your parents against you, you know, and so it was, but again, you know, I've met so many people through writing the book, so many great people, so many wonderful people have come into my life. You know, Kelly Ripa, the talk show host?
No, tell us about her.
Her father, she's a talk show host in New York. She does Regis and Kelly. She was the morning show. Her father is a person I met through this who has also helped me out. And we've still kept in touch after this. And he's been there have been good things that have come about through the negative, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, I mean, you've been through so much pain and trauma, but in your recovery, you have encountered so much goodness and love and healing. You've learned one of the key lessons of trauma work, which is that it's not all bad. Andrew, so how can people learn more about you and how can they support you in your work?
Okay. My book is on Amazon. It's Such Unfortunates by Andrew Mann. I also have a Facebook page, and it's Such Unfortunates. And you can always contact me there or my personal page at Andrew Mann, which is connected. You'll see it under Such Unfortunate, Facebook at Such Unfortunate. And like I said, I'm trying to start the Such Unfortunate Foundation, and I started a GoFundMe for that, which just started up. But it's been going pretty well. I'm giving some of the proceeds from the book toward it, too, so hopefully – you know, I'll find some donors that want to help me start this mission, and you can read about it. If you go on to GoFundMe, it's GoFundMe/unfortunate/foundations, or you just search Such Unfortunate Foundation, Andrew Mann. It'll come up there. And like I said, you can contact me. I will talk to anyone. If you have questions about your family member, I'll try to help in the best way I can. Just had two women, actually, that wrote to me today about their son, and I'm trying to – the mom said she's got peace by talking to me. So if I can help a family member out by talking to you, I will do whatever I can. You know, I just hopefully will have my own foundation one day where I can have people come and – even if they don't have money, I still want to be able to accept them. And I believe I can heal people. I believe I have the answer to healing the problem inside as well as the physical addiction. And like I said, I'd like to involve animals.
Well, Andrew, this is wonderful. And, you know, you are such a loving man, and you have such resilience and are living, inspiring proof of what is possible in healing and recovery. So I want to wish you very well with your ventures, and I know that if you keep putting out this good loving energy, that good things are going to continue to flow through you to the world. Thank you for all that you do.
Thank you. I really appreciate you having me on your show. You've been great. You're really knowledgeable. It's nice talking to someone that knows just what you said about the rain and everything. It's really nice talking to someone with the knowledge you have. So.
Yeah, it's so good to talk to you. We'll stay in touch. So good. Well, thank you, Andrew. And you're listening to the How to Love Show with Dr. Mike with our guest, Andrew Mann. And I will be right back after the break with a concluding segment. Welcome back to the How to Love Show with Dr. Mike. Dr. Michael McGee here. By the way, you can learn more about me and my work at howtolove.com. Boy, what an inspiring story. I'm so grateful to Andrew Mann coming on and telling us about his story of healing and recovery from his trauma. And it really shows what is possible in terms of doing recovery work. He obviously was willing to do the work, and he also was blessed by somebody seeing his goodness and believing in him, his wife Karen. But he was open to receiving that and was open to doing the hard work. I think it's important to see that he was very traumatized, and that left him feeling just miserable in his skin with depression, anxiety, and panic attacks. And to see with compassion how people use drugs, addiction, fall into addiction, because they're in so much pain, usually from trauma, but also to see how addiction really adds trauma upon trauma. If you didn't have trauma before addiction, boy, you sure will after you fall into addiction. But to see all that with compassion, and also to see that in his healing, that his trauma has had some blessings for him. He's clearly a very, very deep and insightful and loving man who has managed to sort of extract from his trauma a strong passion to help other people. And sometimes the greatest healers are people who have been wounded themselves. I think, what I'm left with in all of this is the work of forgiveness. And we could talk about all the ways to cultivate forgiveness. It's important that to realize that forgiveness is not something that you can just voluntarily decide to do. Just like when you lay down, you can't voluntarily decide to fall asleep. You can set up the conditions for sleeping by laying down in a dark room and maybe having had an active day before so that you're tired. But you can't actually decide when you're going to sleep. So, and forgiveness is the same way. So if you have been harmed, which we all have been, it's really important to engage in a certain number of practices so that forgiveness can arise. I think the first thing is really the practice of grieving. The path of forgiveness really goes through our pain. We really have to process and go through and grieve the harms that have been done to us, and that can take time to do. I think what Andrew talked about was he finally opened up and acknowledged the harm that was done to him. And let out the truth. He spoke the truth in the rehab program, and he was able to feel and honor his pain. That's so important in the grieving process, is to be able to face and embrace and endure and feel the hurt, the betrayal, the anger, rage, even vengeance feelings, guilt, shame, fear, hopelessness. Just to really create a space where you can really fully feel your pain. You've really got to feel it to heal it. Otherwise, if you spend a life avoiding your pain or trying to medicate it, like Andrew did with the heroin, it really just feeds and fuels the pain and makes it worse. But Andrew had the courage to face and process his pain. And he's in the process, I think, of and has done some of this work of putting it into perspective. you know, as you put the pain into a larger perspective, you hopefully come in the grieving process to some sort of deeper understanding of why what happened. For Andrew, he realizes that his mother was severely damaged by the trauma that was visited upon her that she certainly didn't ask for. And that has helped in terms of deepening understanding. And so, you know, in that processing, we let go of maybe shame or guilt that we feel or any responsibility that we might have for what others have done to us. And then, as Andrew did, integrate this into a larger life context that includes all that's good in life. You know, while Andrew was being really abused and damaged, you know, there was also good happening in terms of some processes that were allowing him to live and make it by from day to day, and food and shelter and finding his way to healing and a lot of love that he received along the way. And when you see the pain and the harm in a larger context of goodness like that, it really does help to develop wisdom and perspective. And as you deepen your understanding of what happened to you and why, that understanding naturally gives way to compassion. You don't have to force compassion. You don't have to try and be compassionate. All you have to do is, through this kind of deepened understanding and grieving process, you will notice that compassion naturally arises for yourself. So as you do that, then your compassion really creates the fertile soil for forgiveness to arise. I think it works that way. Deep understanding through carefully attending and inquiring into the nature of things, what happened, seeing them and all, coming to a larger perspective, maybe changing our narrative about what happened to a more deeper and more understanding narrative. And then out of that narrative, again, compassion naturally rises. And then from compassion, forgiveness grows. There's other things that you can do to cultivate forgiveness. I can maybe talk about that on another show. But this step of grieving is such an important step. So encourage you to if you haven't completely gone through that process, not that we all go through it completely, but to encourage you in that process of facing and grieving the wounds and pain that you've suffered. Well, this has been a good program. I hope you've enjoyed it. And until next week, I want to wish you well, wish you a week of love. A life of love, a life of loving and being loved. I hope to have you with us again next week. Until then, take care.